a normal male projection. This isn't me. The woman tempted me, and I ate. The woman was provocative. But in fact, Angelo is a pretty smart guy, and he sees instantly that Isabella hasn't tempted him. Not she, nor doth she tempt, but it is I that, lying by the violet in the sun, do as the carrion does, not as the flower, corrupt with virtuous season. It is I. And Shakespeare emphasizes the I by repeating the vowel sound. It is I that, lying by the violet in the sun, that assonance, that repeated I, as he dwells on the self that astonishes him. In the sun, she is a flower, she is a violet. She will blossom, she will give forth a sweet odor. But I am like carrion. I am like meat, dead meat. I will stink in contrast to the sweet smell of the flower. He goes on. Can it be that modesty may more betray our sense than woman's lightness? Having waste ground enough, shall we desire to raise the sanctuary and pitch our evils there? He's really surprised to find that this woman, who is dressed as a novice, who is dressed in sober religious clothes, can tempt him in the way a harlot, a strumpet, dressed in the clothes of her trade, would not. Woman's modesty is betraying his sense, his sensual nature. And he suspects some kind of bizarre thing going on in himself. There are brothels, there is waste ground, there are trash heaps. But what this involves, this situation between his feelings for Isabella, is that he desires to raise the sanctuary, to knock down the church, and pitch his evils there, to build a brothel on the sanctified spot. Oh, fie, 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 what dost thou, or what art thou, Angelo? Now that's the key move in the speech. Angelo's growth of self-perception. First he's disgusted, oh, fie, fie, fie. And then the move from what dost thou to what art thou. That's a big move to make. We can do many things without defining ourselves in terms of those things. Oh, I did this, I accidentally did that, I drove too fast that night, but I'm not habitually a reckless driver. I don't define myself that way. But Angelo sees that he has discovered some fundamental part of his identity, so that his doing this, his lusting after Isabella, tells him something about who he really is. He isn't going to blame circumstances, to blame an accidental thing for his current state. He knows it's in him. He goes on, dost thou desire her foully for those things that make her good? You want to exert your lust on someone who is good? It is the virtue itself that is tempting? Oh, let her brother live. Thieves for their robbery have authority when judges steal themselves. He immediately sees, as I say, he's a very smart guy, immediately sees the paradox he's gotten into. Here he is lusting after the girl whilst condemning her brother for committing fornication. Then he thinks for one moment that this might be an innocent feeling. He says, what? Do I love her? That I desire her, hear her speak again, and feast upon her eyes? For that one moment, he thinks, possibly this is love. And I could court her, woo her, in the ordinary way. To see her again, to feast upon her eyes, to court her, and so forth. Carry on as any young man might with a young woman. But no, he sees that is not the case. What is't I dream on? O cunning enemy, that to catch a saint with saints dost bait thy hook. He sees that what he wants is sin, that the devil is working in him, that he doesn't desire to court, to woo, to marry her. He desires to have her. It is the sin itself he wants. He goes on, most dangerous is that temptation that doth goad us on to sin in loving virtue. The enemy is very cunning, the devil is. He adjusts our temptations to what we are. And he has given Angelo a most dangerous temptation. Angelo's own love of virtue is being used to lead him into vice. The novice, the pious young girl, is being used to provide him with a temptation that he hadn't felt before. He goes on. Never could the strumpet with all her double vigor, art and nature once stir my temper, but this virtuous maid subdues me quite. Ever till now, when men were fond, I smiled and wondered how. He thought he was different from other men. And indeed he was different from other men. The strumpet, with all her double vigor, art and nature, that is, the whore with her natural beauty, heightened by cosmetics and dress and so forth, could never stir his temper. He was never in the least moved to sleep with a loose woman. But this virtuous maid subdues me quite. He discovers he's not better than other men. He's worse than other men. He is moved into lust. And the form of lust that he is moved in is a kind of desecration, to violate the nun rather than to use the whore for the purpose for which the whore is presumably willing. And he ends with rejecting his own vanity. Ever till now, when men were fond, I smiled and wondered how. I went about thinking, how can these guys be so foolish as to follow the whores back to their brothels? They are fond, they are silly. How can they do that? But now I've discovered something like it in myself, something even worse. This, as I say, is one of the great soliloquies in Shakespeare. It is one of those great statements of identity. It's like Henry V saying, I am a king that find thee, and I know, Henry, working out what it means to be a king. Or King Lear saying, I am a very foolish, fond old man. I'm not a king at all. I'm just a silly old geezer. These are speeches running through Shakespeare, to which I will come back. In this particular case, it's part of a whole pattern throughout Measure for Measure. Claudio said that sexual desire is like rat's bane. Isabella sent Claudio off to execution. I'll pray 1,000 prayers for thy death. Angelo says he's like carrion next to the flower of Isabella. That is, sexuality leads to death. And on the road to death, we go through self-hatred and a complete lack of charity to others.
The lecturer is Professor Peter Saccio. Professor Saccio is an award-winning professor and accomplished writer, actor, and theatrical director. He received his Ph.D. from Princeton University and began his teaching career at Dartmouth College in 1966, where he continues today. He has also served as a visiting professor at Wesleyan University and at University College in London. Professor Saccio has published or delivered at conferences more than 20 papers on Shakespeare and other dramatists. He is the author of two books, including Shakespeare's English Kings, which was released in 1977 and has become a classic in its field. He is also the editor of Thomas Middleton's comedy, A Mad World, My Masters, for the Oxford Complete Works of Thomas Middleton. In addition to his writing and public speaking career, Professor Saccio is also an accomplished director and actor. He has directed productions of Twelfth Night, Macbeth, and Cymbeline, and has devised and directed several programs of scenes from Shakespeare and from modern British drama. His acting credits include the Shakespearean roles of Casca, Angelo, Bassanio, and Henry IV, as well as various parts in the ancient and modern plays. His teaching awards include Dartmouth's J. Kenneth Huntington Memorial Award for Outstanding Teaching. Each of Professor Saccio's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Photographs of on-stage productions for this series were provided in part by the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. The lectures on these tapes are titled William Shakespeare, Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies, Part 1.
In the previous lecture, I was speaking about the ways in which Measure for Measure differs from other Shakespearean comedies, that it is unromantic, that it is claustrophobic, that it treats sex as painful and death-dealing. It is unusual also in its title. Shakespearean plays are usually named after the title, after the principal characters, Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, or they're named after some principal event in the play, The Tempest, The Taming of the Shrew. Some of Shakespeare's titles are pure whimsy, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, or What You Will. But in this case, the title directly names a thematic concern. The title of this play is drawn from the Gospel according to St. Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7. Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. That is, Jesus warned his followers not to judge one another, for we are all sinners, and therefore we risk judgment by the same standards we apply to others. Now, this title is obviously appropriate to Angelo. He falls into the same sin for which he condemns Claudio. And, in fact, the lines about Measure for Measure are quoted by the Duke in the last scene of the play when he is judging Angelo. But the Christian principle is, in fact, very difficult to apply. If we dispense with judgment, how can we maintain an orderly civil society? It's very well to say that we should personally forgive others, but how do we maintain domestic order on a larger scale in a city such as Vienna? Now, central to the large difference between Measure for Measure and the standard Shakespearean romantic comedies is the law that brings Claudio to the chopping block. Fornication, that is, sexual intercourse outside of marriage, is in Vienna a capital crime. Now, it is characteristic of Shakespearean comedy that the characters must deal with some law or decree, some arbitrary ukase that serves as an obstacle toward their happiness. In Midsummer Night's Dream, for example, ancient Athens has a law that says a young woman must marry the man her father picks out for her. If she does not, then she dies the death or enters a convent. Perpetual chastity. In The Merchant of Venice, Portia, according to her father's will, must marry the man who correctly gathers the answer to a difficult riddle that he has set. Now, in those two cases, both of those plot premises are realistic only to this extent, that they reflect the authority of fathers in a patriarchal society. But they are not realistic in themselves. They are absurd exaggerations of that authority. The Elizabethans had a patriarchal society, but there are patriarchies and patriarchies, and they certainly didn't allow fathers to exert such arbitrary, total, and whimsical tyranny as a girl must marry the man her father picks out or her head gets cut off. In other words, what these laws do in standard Shakespearean comedy is set up a revealing dramatic situation. Characters have to respond to them, and thus the plot gets going. Once they've done the work, then those laws can be set aside. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, the Duke benevolently waives the law about paternal authority once the lovers have sorted out their own arrangements for themselves. In The Merchant of Venice, Bassanio's intelligence can solve the riddle of Portia's father's casket. But the case is different in Measure for Measure. The fornication law is realistic. Not historically accurate. I must make a distinction here. The Elizabethans were not quite as severe as to say that anybody who committed fornication should die the death. They use the death penalty for more crimes than we do, but the only sexual acts punishable by death in Shakespeare's London were forcible rape and the seduction of children under 10 years old. Lesser offenses, such as fornication, were punishable by fines and by public shame. Nonetheless, this law that Shakespeare invents for his Vienna is not whimsical. An eager moral minority of his time did argue for stronger penalties in sexual matters. There was a Puritan contemporary of Shakespeare's named Stubbs who wrote a book called The Anatomy of Abuses, in which he urged that the death penalty should be imposed upon people who committed fornication or incest, and adultery as well. Some thoughtful people, in other words, hoped that such laws would be passed. Other thoughtful people argued against them. The situation is as it might be now if an American playwright wrote a play whose premise was there is a law imposing very severe penalties on both the doctor and the woman in all cases of abortion, whatever the reason for the abortion. That isn't the law now, but some people want it to be the law. If a playwright wrote such a play now, we would consider it as a realistic possibility. Now, like much severe legislation, this capital punishment for fornication in Vienna business has not been enforced very strictly for years before the action of the play. But Measure for Measure develops the sexual life of Vienna in such a way as to make the audience feel that some such laws are necessary. Early in the play, the Duke himself observes that we have strict statutes and most biting laws, and they've been allowed to lapse. And the result is obscene disorders, the proliferation of brothels. And a general contempt for law itself, so that some kind of cleanup is necessary. And he's selected Angelo to be his deputy because he thinks that Angelo can carry out that cleanup. Angelo's first proclamation is that all the brothels in the town shall be plucked down. And it is done. We first meet Mistress Overdone when she has suffered the loss of her place of work. Of course, the brothels spring up in new places right away. Mistress Overdone gets back to work with a new house, lightly disguised as a tavern. Sex then presents civil authority with grave problems. It is this confrontation of sex and civil authority that has made Measure for Measure so compelling for our own time. Measure for Measure was not a popular play in the 19th century. The Victorian period did not like to discuss sexual matters of this kind on the stage. But at the turn of the century, critics began to take a fresh interest in the play and differentiated it from Shakespeare's other comedies by calling it a problem play or problem comedy. That is, a play dealing with social problems in the manner of the new social drama written by Ibsen and Shaw at the turn of the century. And in the 20th century, Measure for Measure has gained very great popularity. It has become an important play in the Shakespearean canon. It suits our post-Victorian frankness about sex. And it suits our worries about the regulation of sex. And a lot of our public discourse these days is about sex. What's on our public agenda? Well, of course, there are non-sexual issues as well. We worry about race and about drugs and about violence and education and a number of things. But we also worry about the equality of women, about the status of the family at a time when single parenthood and divorce and cohabitation without marriage are common. We worry about the rights of gay and lesbian people. We worry about the relation of public authority to abortion, pornography, the spread of socially transmitted diseases, sexually transmitted diseases. And most spectacularly, with business executives and Supreme Court justices and presidents, we worry about the sexual harassment of women by men who have authority over them. In the past 2 decades, audiences of Measure for Measure have found that productions of this play speak directly to our present concerns. So let us look at the ways in which authority tries to cope with the teeming sexuality of Vienna in this play. Specifically, I shall look at 3 authority figures: Angelo, Isabella, and the Duke. Angela's formulation for dealing with our sexual urges is repression. Each person should exert continuous self-control, self-discipline. Run around the block, take a cold shower, just say no. For society at large, the first part of that was a formula for individuals. For society at large, use the law to back up Christian ethics. Define sexual sins as legal crimes and punish the sinners. Execute these criminals. This is the Puritan response, urged by some of Shakespeare's own contemporaries, such as the man named Stubbs I mentioned before. Purify yourself and purify the commonwealth. It's a beautifully clear solution. And like most clear solutions to social problems, terribly drastic. It allows very little room for human nature. This point is made to Angelo early in the play. A more lenient colleague of his, Aeschylus by name, suggests to him that many people give away to sexual urges, and that under the right circumstances, or you might call them the wrong circumstances, Angelo himself might fall. Now, Angelo responds to that, but not in the way that Aeschylus wants him to. He doesn't say, since I too am human and might fall, I will behave mercifully toward Claudio. What he says is the converse of that. He says, if I too fall, then punish me just as severely. Not the answer Aeschylus wants. But he means it, and he acts on that principle. He would submit to strict justice. He really is quite consistent, Angelo is, until he double-crosses Isabella by ordering the execution. When his deeds are all revealed at the end, he returns to that consistency. He does not beg for mercy himself in the final scene of the play. He prays for execution. No longer session hold upon my shame, but let my trial be mine own confession Immediate sentence, then, and sequent death is all the grace I beg. That he is finally spared is entirely the idea of Mariana, and eventually Isabella and the Duke, too. Angelo has never been a very sympathetic character, a popular character, but Shakespeare is sufficiently sympathetic with him to help us to understand him. My students tend to think of Angelo as a kind of middle-aged authoritarian, a corrupt old judge who just takes advantage of his position to get a nice young girl into his bed. But I find the play works better if Angelo is played as a somewhat younger character. I've seen him convincingly played as a man in his late 20s or thereabouts, a studious, ambitious fellow who has ignored the idle pleasures of his contemporaries and devoted himself to religion and politics and government, who has worked hard and therefore earned quick promotion in the authority of Vienna, earned high office. He's eager to put his ideas to work for the benefit of society. That is, a young zealot who is quite sincere, but has never taken the time to inquire deeply into his own nature, who is seriously inexperienced in some aspects of human life. His own fall into desire, of course, reveals the flaw in his Puritan ideals. But I think he does demand our sympathy. His condition is part of the human condition. I've seen far too many young Puritans myself, both on the religious right and the non-religious left, eager to reform society in one way or another, to deny them a part in the complexion of human abundance. Isabella looks quite different. She does not appear to be condemnatory. In her first scene with Angelo, indeed, she speaks some of the most eloquent pleas for mercy ever written for a dramatic character. She equals Portia in The Merchant of Venice. As a postulant nun, she derives those pleas directly from Christian doctrine. We are all sinful. We all require mercy. God, who might have punished us, found out the remedy for our sinfulness. He himself took the punishment, died for us, and therefore made mercy available to us. Likewise, we must be merciful if we are to get mercy ourselves. That is in the formula of the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against ourselves. Or, as she says, and to Angelo, go to your bosom, knock there, ask your heart what it doth know that's like my brother's fault. If it confess a natural guiltiness such as is his, let it not sound a thought upon your tongue against my brother's life. If there's anything in your heart that's like my brother's heart, issue the pardon for him. In society, we must forgive one another. In personal life, in personal relationships, Isabella plans to withdraw. Where Angelo's formula is repress, hers is retreat. Retreat from the squalor of Vienna, from the temptations of the world, and from being one of the world's temptations. She has chosen to enter a convent. She has chosen, in fact, to enter the order called Poor Clares. And the rule of that order, as is explained in her first scene, is very strict indeed. If a nun speaks to a man, she may not show her face as she does so. And if she shows her face, she may not speak. You must not present too much temptation to anybody. Now, this, of course, is the monastic solution to the problem of sex in society. the radical Roman Catholic position of Shakespeare's day, the extreme right of the political spectrum, as the Puritan position was the extreme left. Shakespeare criticizes Isabella much less severely than he does Angelo. For hers, by and large, is a private solution. To retreat into a convent, into a monastery, is honorable and heroic for those who have a gift in that direction, for those who are supported by the grace of God, a theologian would say. And the monastic solution does not usually try to impose itself on populations as a whole. It doesn't impose its values upon other people. But I have said that Isabella is a figure of authority nonetheless, because in the middle of the play she does climb into the judgment seat. When Claudio succumbs to the fear of death, aye, but to die, to go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot, 'tis too horrible to think of. When he has a frightened outcry of that kind, she responds with the hysterical abuse that I quoted in the last lecture. Oh, you beast, you faithless coward, die, perish. Now, this is difficult for her, and it is difficult for us to judge her. I mean, twice she declares that she'd die herself, that she'd rather die, that she would be willing to die for Claudia. And I think she means that. She is the kind of heroic person who could undergo death in order to save her brother's life. Unfortunately, that's not what's been asked of her. It is one thing to say, death before dishonor. It is another thing to say, your death before my dishonor. Does anybody ever have a right to say that? I don't think so. Yet it is hard to condemn her altogether. Some of my students, mostly men, conclude that she's prudish, frigid, terrified of sex. And that seems harsh to me. She's a young woman in an age that sheltered young women and that valued physical chastity much more than we do in the 20th century. And she wants to join a convent where chastity, of course, carries a very high value indeed. Others of my students, and these are mostly women, are outraged on Isabella's behalf that these men, such as Angelo and Claudio, should be trading in her sexuality. And they condemn not only Angelo, but Claudio too. And I think that's also harsh. The heart of her problem, I think, doesn't have to do with chastity. It has to do with charity, with her failure to sympathize with her brother when he succumbs to the terror of execution. She has a youthful enthusiasm, but like Angelo, she is also inexperienced. Her enthusiasm momentarily turns her into a judgmental zealot. Now, our third authority figure is the Duke, who is directly or indirectly in charge of the plot. And he exerts that control to ensure that Claudio does not die, that Isabella is not violated, and at the end all facts are revealed and everybody is brought to judgment. And the judgments are finally merciful. Most extraordinarily, he gets Isabella to plead for mercy for Angelo, even before she knows her brother is still alive. Isabella recognizes that she herself is part of the sinful human condition. And she says, "Most bounteous sir, look, if it please you, on this man condemned, as if my brother lived. I partly think a due sincerity governed his deeds till he did look on me. Since it is so, let him not die." Now, it isn't her fault that Angelo felt. She isn't taking the blame. But she is involved in it nonetheless. Sincerity governed his deeds till he did look on me. She was an occasion of sin, however unconsciously. She is part of the human condition, the sinful human condition. She joins the human race. That plea and much else comes about at the end of the play because of the Duke's disguises and manipulations of the plot. The bed trick and the head trick make a comic conclusion possible for Measure for Measure. And those are not the least of his devices. His initial abdication of authority, leaving Angelo in power, charging him with cleaning up the city, follows precisely a bit of advice given by Machiavelli. If a prince has some onerous task to carry out in the city, go away, appoint some deputy to do the job. He'll get all the odium. Then you come back and hear everybody moaning and say, oh, he went beyond the charge. We'll get rid of him. The job is done and your reputation isn't stained. Throughout the play, the Duke tests theories of life and death, techniques of rule, the characters of men and women. And out of his experimentation, he devises a sort of solution for the problems of Vienna. To put it in a nutshell, that solution is forgive and get them married. Forgive the sinners, since we all require forgiveness, and get them married, since we require some defined space in order to work out our sexual urges, fulfill our sexual desires. That recipe responds to the extreme solutions of Angelo and Isabella, where Angelo says punish, the Duke says forgive, where Isabella says withdraw, the Duke proposes marry. Now, the Duke's supervening knowledge and control, together with his disguise as a friar and his highly Christian solution to the problems of the play, have suggested to some readers and theatrical producers that he is in some way or other an embodiment of God himself. He seems to have providential status, and one speech of Angelo's in the final scene of the play does attribute to him a divine power, or compare him with a divine power. If that were the case, it would accord with contemporary political theory, which after all did grant divine right to kings. But many other readers find that the Duke's solutions are less than wholly satisfactory for the problems of Vienna. Lives are saved and marriages are arranged, but nothing is done about the fornication law with which the problems started. Nothing is done about Pompey, the pimp turned into executioner. Mistress Overdone is arrested, but the brothels are still around. And a number of minor characters whom the Duke encounters prove quite recalcitrant to his plans. The play never questions the necessity of earthly authority. But it does acknowledge that earthly authority is often mistaken or inadequate. Even well-meaning authorities like the Duke. I can put these problems sharply if I return to the marriages that happen at the end of the play, the marriages that I stressed at the opening of the first lecture. Claudio is to marry Juliet. That's right and proper in every way. Mariana marries Angelo. That legitimizes her position, and she's still in love with him, so that's fine for her. Or is it? Not all frogs turn into princes. Is he going to be a good husband to her? Lucio, the young wastrel go-between, is required to marry a prostitute upon whom he's fathered a child. Well, he certainly ought to take responsibility for the results of his actions. But the marriage isn't imposed upon him for that reason. It's imposed upon him because he slandered the Duke. This is a punishment for royal calumny. And the prostitute's wishes are not consulted about the matter. She's not an onstage character. And the Duke's proposal of marriage to Isabella comes as a complete surprise to the audience. We have heard no word of their being romantically interested in one another. The proposal may come as a complete surprise to Isabella herself. Shakespeare gives Isabella no speech in response to the Duke's proposal of marriage. It is left up entirely to us in the audience, or to the director and actress in a production, how she does respond. I have seen in Isabella, who shyly and movingly stretched out her hand to this man whom she has learned to admire and trust. I have also seen an Isabella who shrieked with horror at this idea and fainted dead away at one more manipulation from this Duke. The point I am making is this. The four weddings at the end of the play look very much like naked comic formula. This is the way comedies are supposed to end. And that's fine if it really suits the character's desires. But what if it doesn't? And it very well may not in this unromantic Vienna. The final problem about this problem comedy is that comedy itself may be a problem. The patterns of comedy may not be adequate to the facts of human nature. Judged as a comedy, Measure for Measure has much to say about sin and mercy and law and the necessity for forgiveness. But there is something contrived about its close. Judged, on the other hand, as a play that bursts the limits of comedy, that asks whether standard dramatic patterns can contain the variety and perverseness of human nature, Measure for Measure is a deeply engrossing, highly provocative theatrical experiment. Hello. Shakespeare wrote 10 plays named after English kings. And it was John Hemmings and Henry Condell, Shakespeare's partners in the Lord Chamberlain's men, who decided that we would call these plays of Shakespeare his histories. When, 7 years after Shakespeare's death, they published 36 of his plays in a single volume, they called the book Master William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies. The Elizabethans didn't mind cumbersome book titles. We now refer to the book more briskly as the First Folio. And Hemmings and Condell arranged the book in corresponding categories. First comedies, then the 10 histories, and then the tragedies. There are some problems about this word history. Shakespeare's plays on ancient Roman subjects treat equally historical matter, sometimes with greater fidelity to the sources he used. But Hemmings and Condell put those plays into the tragedy section. His plays on British subject matter before the Norman conquest, King Lear, Cymbeline, Macbeth, although they handle legendary events, display in them some historical concern. Shakespeare could use the word history very freely. All the Elizabethans could use the word history very freely at times, sometimes meaning no more than story. It is sometimes used on the title page of comedies and tragedies that are purely fictional works. It is difficult, in fact, to discern any formal principle distinguishing the 10 plays on English kings as examples of a single genre. Some focus on the king named in the title, as Richard III does. Some do not. Henry IV is only a supporting character in the two plays named after him. Some end happily for the king. Some do not. They are structured in different ways. As used in the folio, history seems to be a category defined by subject matter. A history play is a play that dramatizes major events from the reign of an English king, a reign sufficiently recent so that the events were known in some detail. The playwright may, to some degree, rearrange the events, develop characters, invent or omit incidents. That is, he may take historical liberties out of artistic necessity, so long as the result is felt to reflect the received conception of the times in question. In Shakespeare's Richard III, for example, Richard courts the Lady Anne over the corpse of her father-in-law. He wins her hand in marriage, and the marriage proves to be a barren one. Well, in fact, Shakespeare's sources gave him no information about how Richard courted Anne, and the marriage produced at least one son who died before he came to adulthood. But the courtship scene is a splendidly theatrical invention displaying Richard's mesmerizing power over other people. And that is an important thing to get on stage, even if you have to invent an incident to do it. And the birth of a child who didn't survive long enough to be of any dynastic significance can safely be ignored in favor of a larger truth about how sterile Richard's reign was as a whole. What Shakespeare could not have changed was, say, the outcome of the Battle of Bosworth, by which Henry Tudor displaced Richard on the English throne. Now, Shakespeare was perfectly willing to change the outcome of a major battle when he was dealing with a more legendary story, with the story of King Lear, for example. But if you have Richard III win at Bosworth, you have sacrificed your claim to historical authority. Writing a play like that would be like the Monty Python sketch in which an Italian Renaissance painter paints a Last Supper with 27 disciples and 3 Christs. Everybody knows how many people were present at that meal. Now, there was a flood of historical writing at this period in the 1590s. Shakespeare drew his information especially from 2 enormous books, one compiled by Edward Hall called The Union of the 2 Noble and Illustrious Families of Lancaster and York, and one by Raphael Holinshed called The Chronicles of England, Ireland, Scotland. And there were many other historians, and there were poets who wrote long historical narratives in verse. And English history enjoyed a particular vogue on the stage. Every English monarch, from William the Conqueror to Elizabeth herself, was put on the stage during the 1590s, some of them more than once. We know the titles of at least 70 English history plays that came out over a stretch of about 15 years, between the Armada in 1588 and the death of the Queen herself in 1603. We only have the text of about 35 of those plays. We know the titles of the other 35 because they appear in the records of one theatrical entrepreneur, the only theatrical entrepreneur whose records we have. If we had access to the records of other theatrical companies, presumably we would know about a lot more history plays. Now, this is a remarkable number of plays to be drawn from a nation's own history and offered as public entertainment. We may get an occasional history play on Broadway now, but you don't expect to have plays about every president from Washington to Bush over a period of a decade or 15 years. History obviously exerted a particular appeal for the Elizabethans. For one thing, it appealed to patriotic impulses. Patriotism was an especially powerful feeling for Protestant Englishmen in the years immediately after the defeat of the Spanish Armada. England was a small, relatively underpopulated island nation, and it had withstood an attempt at invasion by the greatest power in Europe, backed by all the gold of the New World. Some Elizabethans were convinced also that history was instructive, It provided heroes and villains that the present generation could use as models. It provided patterns of events that could serve as warnings. For they were inclined to believe that history repeated itself. Generally, this works out as negatively, since history is largely a record of disasters anyway. Past disasters can serve as warnings to the present. Don't do this, don't do that, look what happened to so-and-so when they tried it. In the 1590s, most of the English history plays concern disputes over the crown. Royal persons squabble over who should be next to inherit the kingdom. Now, that issue was of major importance in the 1590s. Queen Elizabeth was in her 60s. She had never married. She had outlived all her close relatives. It was not at all clear who her heir would be, and her death could not be far off. Now, no mere playwright would have dared to say so-and-so should be declared heir to the throne. That would really be interfering with high affairs. In fact, the Queen rebuked Parliament itself for talking about that. But a playwright or an historian could at least warn of the dangers of a disputed succession, could say, in effect, agree on the identity of the next monarch. Do not let disagreement drive the country into civil war. Look what happened the last time. The Wars of the Roses went on for decades, ending in the reign of the diabolical Richard III. Terrible time. We don't want that to happen again. It also seems clear that there was a practical reason for this outburst of history play writing in the 1590s. A theatrical hunger. The theaters had become popular at the end of the 80s and on through the 90s. But a standard public theater held as many as 2,000 or 3,000 people. London was a city of only 200,000, by no means all of whom went to the theater. Even a successful play would exhaust its appeal quickly. The playwrights were under pressure to provide scripts for stages that ate them up very fast. All this historical material, available in Hall and Holinshed and the other chroniclers and the poets, served as a stockpot, a pantry of plots and characters for playwrights seeking new subjects. I can imagine a conversation backstage at the Rose or the Swan. Hey, we need a new play. Has anybody done anything about Henry II? He had a bitch of a queen. He had some sons who fought against him. We could get a couple of plays out of that. Get somebody to write that up. There was even a considerable amount of recycling. For example, the most theatrical, the most successful theatrical company of the 1580s was a group called the Queen's Men. It was formed in 1583. It dominated the scene for the rest of the 80s. It was driven out of London when a plague closed the theaters for a long stretch in 1593 and 94. It is possible, this is sheer speculation,